everybody. It is time for the Mainland Podcast. I am an under-the-weather Michael Citro, the founder and managing editor of themainland.com. Welcome to episode number 105 of the Mainland Podcast. Joining me, as always, is Mainland writer David Rowe. Dave, how are you?
Well, I'm over the weather, as in I'm ready for it to be fall. Frankly, it's still too dang hot at this point in the year, but, you know, between the two of us, we even out.
Even Steven, that's how it goes. Okay, so absolutely nothing happened this past weekend, so let's just move on. There was no Orlando City game to speak of, and nothing happened, and all is right with the world, and I don't even know why we're doing this podcast. Of course, that would be nice if it were true, but it's not true. The Portland Timbers, congratulations to the Portland Timbers. It took them three tries to get their first win against the mighty Orlando City. A 3-0 victory, basically a win in every facet of the game. I don't think you can even say that Orlando City was ever in the game from the opening kickoff on. It was just an onslaught of we're going to press high, we're going to run at you, we're going to use our speed, and you're not going to be able to deal with it. And that basically happened. Jonathan Spector getting himself in trouble in the 15th minute with a yellow card takedown in the box of Darren Maddox. It was an unfortunate play, Dave, because really it was originally not called a foul. In live action, it did look like Spector got the ball. And in the replay, you could see that Darren Maddox just made a play. You got to tip your cap to him. He got his foot all the way around in front of Spector as he was already sliding, and he clipped the back foot. And they went to video review. It was a penalty. And, Diego Valeri is scorching hot. He wasn't going to miss a penalty. And he made it 1-0 just a quarter of an hour in. So already you're chasing the game. And it was just not ever going to be Orlando's night. It's one of those things where you never know what happens if there's no video review. Maybe City poaches one on a counter or something, or a set piece, and takes a lead, and then, you know, it could change the whole complexion of the game. As they say, goals change games. But it didn't change games. This goal just basically put the foot on the throat of Orlando City, and before you knew it, it was 2-0. Could have been much worse if not for some Joe Bendik heroics, a lot of 1v1 stops, and even beyond saves, just kind of throwing attackers off when he came out of his net a few times, to where they got a little indecisive and lost the ball and that kind of thing. So, you know, in the second half, you thought, okay, maybe there's a lifeline back into this game. We're going to change shape. We're going to go to a 4-2-3-1. We haven't done that in a long time. Let's see what happens. Less than two full minutes in, Spector gets a silly yellow card, really just a late challenge on Valeri, who, you know, made pretty darn sure that that ref was going to see that foul by milking that and making a meal of it. You know, it's nothing that everybody doesn't do. So,
and it's not like it wasn't a foul.
It was a foul, and it was a yellow card foul, and I'm definitely not going to defend Spector on that one. He was late. He knew it. Second yellow. Just an unbelievably ridiculous place to get and time to get a yellow card. You know, no threat, no danger. Valeri is a good player, but, I mean, it was near the freaking midfield line. You're not going to score from there. No real reason to do it. And so, you know, then you're down a man. You're down two goals. It's pretty much done and dusted. Valeri added another one, and the final was 3-0. I don't think we really need to say anything else about this game.
No, you're right. I mean, they were just chasing it from the get-go, and quite frankly, they were slower. So if you were slower chasing something faster, you're not going to catch it.
So, Dave, this is an interesting thing, because the team flew out on Thursday. They usually fly out the day before a game, and they flew out on Thursday. So an extra night in the city where they were going to play. They've done this four times now this year, where they've been in the city where they're going to play more than a day in advance. Mm-hmm. Those games were a 4-0 loss at Houston, a 4-0 loss at Chicago, a 4-0 loss at New England Revolution, and a 3-0 loss that could have been much, much worse at Portland. Do you sense any kind of a pattern here?
You know what? I'm definitely a facts guy. Let's, you know, if something is trending and you can, you know, if there is a, even if it's just correlation, if not causality, well, gosh darn it. Perhaps somebody should take a look at that, and maybe we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously not working.
No, I would say don't go to the city early. Go the last possible second. Like get off the plane, get on a bus, go right to the bus, get into the locker room, get your gear changed, and go right onto the field and play. Time it out just perfectly, just like that.
That was exactly my thought, and you know, down to the second, where you know there's somebody sitting there looking at a watch, going, "Okay, come on, we got to hurry up, let's go," because oh, geez, that's a lot of goals.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the goal differential, and when you know 15 of them are in those four games, a minus 15 in those four games, that tells you that the extra day in the city is not working. I don't know if the guys are going out seeing the sights, if you know what I mean, or if it's just the extra night in the hotel room, you know, or if it's just a coincidence, which you know it could be. I don't know what it is. All I know is it isn't working. And
so why not try something different?
Yeah, if it's broke, fix it. This is the opposite of what the old saying is. So anyway, again, a loss to Portland. First time they've lost to Portland. And you know, so kudos to Orlando City for still owning a winning record against the Portland Timbers, which is it's been a pretty good team since Orlando's been in the in the league. And you know, my man of the match is going to be Joe Bendick because nobody else really is even in consideration.
Yeah, this is going to be a shocker, but my man of the match is Joe Bendick because he was the only one on the field that did anything that was remotely good.
Yeah, he helped. He made it not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah, 4-0, 3-0 was bad. 4-0, if it had matched those other games, was much more likely. And it probably would have been even worse than that, honestly, if it hadn't been for Joey B, because he made some amazing saves. He came out and broke some things up. There was, as you're sitting there watching this horrible thing unfold before you, the one bright spot every once in a while is, hey, that was a good save by Joe.
Yeah, exactly. Way too many times 1v1. It was sad. It was just sad to see, and you know, especially once Spectre got sent off, it was just all everything was terrible and nothing will ever be good again kind of time. And you know, what does all this matter when the sun's going to explode someday? That kind of thing. You know, it all got existential at that point.
I'm not sure what you're speaking of, because I don't remember anything happening then.
PC also got tossed for a silly elbow, not a hard elbow. I mean,
no,
probably the softest elbow you can throw at somebody. I don't even know if you could say he threw the elbow. I would say he moved the elbow. He put the elbow up. He didn't really throw it. I will say that Diego Chara is either Mr. Glass or he was just working on he was workshopping some acting skills there.
I was gonna say he's either Mr. Glass or he's Bobby Darino, De Niro, one of the two. So you know, give him the Academy Award, and you know, let's yeah, that was frustrating.
Yeah, Chara threw the shoulder blade into PC's back right before that, and and it got under the Brazilian skin, and you know, he put up the arm, the elbow went in the face, and Chara did the rest, and then the referee did the rest of that. So that was that. PC, hope you enjoyed your 7 minutes, because you're not going to be playing on Wednesday against New England with the suspension, and at this point we haven't heard if that will be extended, but you know, violent conduct is often punished pretty severely by the league. Throwing elbows can get you an extra game or two. Again, this was the softest of elbows, but it was an elbow. So God only knows what the disco will do. We don't, you know, it's like
yeah,
it's like on Seinfeld when when Jackie Childs said, "You never know what a bomb is going to do. Don't put a bomb on it. You don't know what a bomb's going to do. You don't know what disco is going to do. You never know what disco is going to do." So don't.
Yeah, no. If it was a you know, a reasonable, you know, group of human beings that were able to look at things and judge them appropriately and you know, distinguish levels of good and bad, you know, I might feel okay. Yeah, obviously they could look at it and go, oh well, yes, it was a foul, yes, he got sent off, but you know, perhaps this the one game will suffice. But like you said, disco, who knows, that could be, we might not see him for the rest of the season, who knows.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm going to move on because I can't even process any further thought on that game or give it any more energy because, A, it's not worth it, and, B, I have no energy of my own because I am ill, well, and not just because of the way the team played on Sunday.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Do we have anything better to talk about?
Yeah, we have some things that are better to talk about.
Well, let's do that.
Let's start off by talking about a thing that is marginally better than a loss, which is a draw. Okay. And in this case, a nil-nil draw between the Orlando Pride and the Portland Thorns. So it wasn't a great weekend. No goals scored against Portland teams by Orlando teams. But the, you know, that one completely, that point completely eliminated Seattle Reign's margin of error. At that point, that the Pride drew nil-nil with the Portland Thorns, the Reign needed to do the following. Win both remaining games, because they played Sunday night. They also needed to make up quite an extensive goal differential, and they needed Orlando Pride to lose at North Carolina this coming weekend. Okay. Well, none of that even matters now, because Sunday night, we didn't just get bad news, because we also got good news, because the Seattle Reign at home, mind you, lost to FC Kansas City 1-0 on their home field in their home finale, and against a team that really is in a lot of turmoil based on nobody knows if their ownership is going to change in the offseason, if they're going to move out of Kansas City. It was a very hectic week for FC Kansas City, but they went out and focused on the field, thank God, and scored a goal and got the win. I mean, it really, the Reign could not have even tied that game. They had to win, and they did not do either one of those things. And I can tell you this, I could not watch that game. All I could do was watch Twitter and, you know, get the updates every 5 or 6 minutes, you know, whenever something happened in the game, and just hope that Seattle didn't score a goal, because I was just too nervous. But at the end, FC Kansas City beats Seattle. The Pride had a pretty good game against the Thorns, but could not find a goal. They actually, I thought, were probably the better team, although maybe the Thorns had the single best scoring chance in the game. The Pride had more opportunities, more shots. Mm-hmm. They just couldn't get it done. But a nil-nil draw was the first point that the Pride have ever gotten against Portland Thorns after three losses. In fact, they had given up two goals in each of the games to the Thorns. So to hold them scoreless, that was a pretty nice change of pace, because you look at that team and you got a Tobin Heath and you've got a you know, Lindsey Horan and Ali Long. You know, it's a pretty talented team that they have there, and they were not able to get on the board. So the Pride, David Rowe, have clinched a playoff spot in the NWSL.
Woo! That was the best news that I got all weekend. And like you, I could not watch that Seattle game. I also was just following the Twitters and waiting. And then when it finally came across and you start seeing the tweets from the Pride players and how happy and excited they are. I mean, it was fantastic. We've got a team in the playoffs. It's decided.
Yeah, I was hounding Jackie Maynard of the Pride communications staff for updates on Steph Catley. She had to leave the game with some pain in her knee. That's not something you want to hear about somebody that's been, you know, one of the best players in the league this year, especially at her position, maybe the best player at her position this year in the entire league. And, you know, you're going to need her, you figure, in the playoffs. And Catley, we don't have an update on her condition, but she did have some knee pain, and they said that it was precautionary, but when you say precautionary and then you also say knee pain, that to me is two different things. So I'm waiting with a lot of anxiety to find out Steph Catley's condition. Marta did not look herself. She looked like a player that had just played in Australia just a couple of days earlier
and made traveled the trip. back. Well, you know what? Here, that's a good thing, okay? Because if that's the case, and she looked like that because of all that, then once she gets some rest, she'll be back to normal. She'll be better.
Mm-hmm.
And when you figure that five of the players were in those matches down in Australia, mm-hmm. that means five potential players are going to get better and play better. So that, and they're going to do so at exactly the right time.
Yeah, well, we got to make sure that Steph is healthy. She played well, and also Alana Kennedy played well over the weekend. I thought Camilla played pretty well, and Monica didn't get in the games down there, so she was fine. In fact, she's up for save of the week along with Ashlyn Harris for a ball where Skylar Lee got in and Ashley Sykes. I don't know why I said I got the What I did just there was I got all of the syllables and I mixed them up. But Ashley Sykes got in and got a shot on, and Ashlyn Harris got a good a good piece of it with a hand, but it was still rolling toward the goal, and Monica cleared it just in front of the goal line from danger. So they're up for a save of the week, and you should go vote for that.
I was going to say voting ends as this podcast drops tonight, correct?
You might be right.
Wednesdays?
I think it's tonight. I think it's Wednesday night. So
there's no time, people. Go vote.
Anyway, a good outing, aside from not knowing what Steph Catley's condition is, it wasn't a win, but it was, a step in the right direction. They're unbeaten in eight. They go into North Carolina. Now North Carolina plays Wednesday night. They could wrap up the Supporters Shield, and if they do that, then I expect a lot of starters from both sides might be rested on Saturday.
Yeah.
We might see a lot of Nicolette Dries and some of the bench players for the Pride. Neither team's going to want to tip their hand because they could end up turning around and playing each other again the next weekend. Because as the current standings are, the Pride would go to North Carolina, the team that they end the season against. And I believe the other semifinal would be Portland and Chicago, and I believe they play each other this weekend. So they could turn around and play each other again. The only thing we still don't know is the seedings, because technically Portland could still win the Shield, and the Pride could still jump into third place over Chicago. So there's some variables. But as it stands right now, it would be Chicago at Portland and Orlando at North Carolina. So
now
that would be good, because then they wouldn't have to as far to travel. And if they somehow were able to get that win, then they would play, of course, the NWSL championship in Orlando City Stadium.
Right. Which, obviously that would be ideal. And like you said, we go to North Carolina. It's a good bet that you're not going to see a lot of the stars. So, what happens in that? Who knows? Hopefully the stars align and we get the seeding that we would prefer. Mainly, I think that Orlando is a team that is on the rise, as they have been this second half of the season, just like we predicted at the beginning of the season. And I think it bodes well. They are, for the first time, they go up against Portland. They don't lose. They draw against obviously a very, very good team. And I agree with you. I think they were probably, just from the eyeball test, the better team during the match. It just so happened that, neither team could find the goal. Well, okay, whatever. We still got the results we wanted from this weekend. We're heading to the playoffs. I'm still giddy about it. It's every time I say it, I'm still loving it. Now, sidebar, follow me on this. Tom Dwyer plays for Orlando City, who is in the same organization as the Orlando Pride. Dom is married to Cindy LaRue, who plays for FC Kansas City, who managed to beat Seattle so that the Pride could get in.
Okay.
Now, I'm not one for conspiracy theories, but I'm thinking Sydney helped us out.
Well, I mean, that's her job, right? To win the game.
Okay. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I know. Obviously, I'm looking for something. Not something that's not there. I'm joking, of course. But yeah. It's still fun to think of, you know.
However it happened, the Pride are in the playoffs. They have had more success against the North Carolina Courage / Western New York Flash in terms of victories than they have against the Portland Thorns. Also, the extra travel for the Portland Thorns and playing on turf up there are not ideal. So I think that you'd rather have them playing North Carolina in the semifinals. But I guess it doesn't matter either way, because chances are you're going to have to play both of those teams to win the title.
Very good point. And we just hope that we're in that last game in Orlando City Stadium.
That's right. October 14th is the NWSL Championship in Orlando City Stadium. The semifinals and final are all going to be nationally televised on Lifetime. The semifinals will be the 7th and 8th, whatever the Saturday, Sunday, 7th and 8th at 3:30 p.m. And the final would be the 14th at 4 p.m., I believe, or maybe 4:30. Off the top of my head, it's either 4 or 4:30. But the game at Portland, which whoever plays at Portland would play on the Saturday. Whoever plays at North Carolina would play on the Sunday. So that also would be one less day of rest if they played on the Sunday at North Carolina. So that's another thing to take into account. But I'm selfish and I love college football, so I want them to be off on Saturday. So I want them to play Sunday.
So, we are in agreement on that, sir. Yeah. We are in agreement.
All right. So congrats to the Pride. Congrats to Tom Sermani and to all of his players and the entire staff at the Orlando Pride for making the playoffs. The team finished 9th, Dave, last year. 9th in the league. So quite a season for the Orlando Pride in 2017. So NWSL playoffs, woo! All right. Also, we have other things to talk about. We've talked about a loss. We've talked about a draw. How about if we talk about a win? Can we talk about a win?
Let's talk about a win.
Okay. So talking about a win would be good.
There's only one more team we have.
Yes, we have one more team to talk about, and that is Orlando City B. The Young Lions of OCB played at home against Charleston Battery this weekend in the second game of the doubleheader. And shame on those fans that went to see the Pride and didn't hang around for the Young Lions on Saturday. But I was there for that. And the Young Lions, my friend, came in there on a two-game losing streak in which they'd been outscored 4-0. In fact, had lost 2-0 to a team that they had a numerical advantage against for 35 minutes. So it was not a great run of form at all for Orlando City B. And I got to tell you, the first half of that game on Saturday night was not entertaining soccer. It was mainly played between the boxes, a lot of build-up, and then a bad pass turnover. And then the other team would come, a lot of build-up, and then a bad pass turnover. And it was really excruciating. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Pierre Da Silva scored what might be the goal of the year for OCB. Just absolutely destroyed a ball and put it in off the post and left Odisonel Cooper, the goalkeeper for the Charleston Battery, no chance. And it was 1-0 to OCB. And it was... It was a much more lively second half, Dave. It was a more back-and-forth game, kind of open at times, which I think kind of favored Charleston, especially since they had Romario Williams. He was suspended 3 games, but it got rescinded after 1 game. So, you know, Anthony Pulis said after the game that they knew Wednesday night about the suspension getting rescinded, and he didn't want to talk about the decision and why it was made or any of that stuff, but probably because he didn't want to be fined. But... I really thought that Zach Carroll and Connor Donovan did a great job on Romario Williams. He was very dangerous throughout the game, but they did their best to limit his opportunities to keep him outside, to keep his to limit his danger. I think they really did a great job with that. And nevertheless, of course, this is an Orlando City team, so they gave up a goal in the final 10 minutes, and it was 1-1, and you're like, oh, here we go again. And you were just praying that Charleston didn't find a winner, because at that point, that part of the game, they really had about a 10-minute spell where they were kind of all over Orlando City B and got the goal, and the goal was always coming, and it kind of wasn't even on their best opportunity in that sort of series of events. They got the ball in the box, a guy made a spinning move and kicked it at the goal, and Jake Fenlayson couldn't make the save, so it kind of came out of nothing, but during a good spell for Charleston. And then just in the game's waning minutes, a ball goes into the box, and Timbo gets a crack at it, and it gets blocked, and you're like, oh, because it was such a good opportunity. But the ball falls for Lewis Neal. So Lewis Neal does what Lewis Neal usually does, which is made a mess of it and kicked it right at the goalkeeper. But I don't mean to say that to be mean. No. We've just seen Lewis Neal miss a lot of sitters in the last couple of years. And, he kicks it right at Cooper. And Cooper has it in his hands. And he couldn't handle it for some reason. Didn't have a lot of pace on it. It just was, I don't know if it had some kind of weird spin on it or what, but it went off his hands, off his chest, and off his hands again and into the net. And it was a game winner. And the OCB wins 2-1.
Okay, so most likely there was some weird, because as we know, when Lewis hit that, he probably hit it weird. and so it was probably this little screwball thing, that went in there. And he's thinking that he's got it. Cooper's like, okay, yeah. And hands, chest, hands, goal, what? And I'm sure he probably didn't even know what happened. Neil had no idea what happened until it happened. And none of the rest of us did either until it's you're sitting there and you go, oh, wait, it just went the goal. We won.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of minutes after that to kind of kill off. But OCB, from that point on, I don't even think gave up a shot. They just kept the ball. It was very nice to see. It was very fluid, very, a lot of movement, finding the open man, one-touch passing. And they looked like they were really confident after that second goal. But it was funny after the game, because Lewis Neal even said they brought in Lewis and Pierre to talk after Anthony Pulis did. Neal says, I thought you guys were going to ask us, who had the better goal, because obviously mine was the better strike, kind of giving Pierre the business a little bit. But it was pretty funny. Even Lewis Neal said, he goes, I just put it on goal, and the keeper kind of made the mess of it. He goes, I kind of didn't really challenge him, didn't give him any much to do, and he just made a mess of it. And so, Lewis Neal had a good sense of humor about it. And that's just the way soccer is sometimes. You have these wonder strikes, and they hit the post, and then you have these sloppy little, crap, I didn't hit that well at all, and it goes in. And soccer is a funny game, and that's why it's maddening and lovable all at the same time.
It absolutely is, and the best part of Neil's goal is his response to it, in that interview, and just acknowledging, hey, okay, it wasn't great, guys, but whatever, it went in.
Yeah.
And then the best part of Pierre de Silva's goal was Pierre de Silva's goal. Holy cow! If you have not seen this, go find it on our at themainland.com. Go find the OCB recap from that match. It'll be in there. Mm. And good grief, it is an absolute screamer from 30 yards out, and just nobody had a chance at it. And it hits that post and just goes in. It was hopefully a preview of many, many, many like that to come.
It's funny, because there's not a lot of expressing of emotions going on in the press box when the game's going on. You occasionally get a gasp,
But, sure, man, professional, right?
Yeah, yeah. When Pierre struck that thing and it went in, the entire press box just went whoa! Like it was just a collective whoa in the press box, and it was a crazy good goal, and just it shows you what this kid is capable of. Just 19 years old, and he's got a really bright future ahead, and it would be nice to see. You know, maybe if the Lions get eliminated, he gets called up and gets in a few games here toward the end of the season as a reward for a job well done. Of course, the problem with that is OCB needs him because they're not solidly in the playoffs yet. They did climb to seventh, but there's some teams chasing them, a couple games in hand. So, you know, they need every point they can get. They go to Richmond this Sunday to play the Kickers. They've won there earlier this year, but they also lost at home to the Kickers, so they can't take that for granted. Richmond is a lot more difficult to play at City Stadium than you know on the road, so it's going to be a battle. And then I think three home games left after that for OCB. So I think they're set up for a good finish, but they do play some good teams in those home games. They play Tampa Bay Rowdies is one of them. So they got some good teams coming in, and hopefully Anthony Pulis can get them over the finish line.
Well, hopefully that two-game slide was just that. It was just a two-game slide, and that they take this win and are able to, you know, get back on track, get back on the front foot. And, you know, if they can have anything even, you know, close to what they were playing like during that, you know, 12-game non-losing streak, then, you know, that would bode well. So it remains to be seen, but you're right. Pierre DeSilva would be a big part of making that happen.
Absolutely. All right, so we've talked about a loss, a draw, and a win. And now we got to talk about the future, Dave, and we're going to talk about Orlando City and the New England Revolution on Wednesday night, a midweek game in a double game week. And we'll bring in our special guest now to talk about that game. We'll do that right after this. Joining us on the Mainland Podcast, we are happy to have with us a friend of the program, Jake Catanese from the Bent Musket, our sister site that covers the New England Revolution for SB Nation. Jake, thanks for being on the podcast.
I'm very glad to be back. Is it still called the podcast pod?
We are still very punny over here.
Ah, boo. So
you're only supposed to boo bad puns, and this is not a bad one. This is a good one.
No, all puns are bad. We've had this conversation.
I know, but don't you ever get tired of being wrong, Jake?
I mean, I'm still a Revolution fan.
Well,
so the option there would be no. I guess I'm not
tired of being wrong. Okay.
No.
Jake, I want to ask you a question. I want to start out by asking about the Jay Heaps firing, because you are a longtime New England Revolution fan for reasons known only to yourself.
Yes.
And I see a team that is just absolutely putrid on the road this year, but very, very good. In fact, among the league's best at home. The same guy coached them at home and on the road. Is Jay Heaps a fall guy for a bigger problem, or was Jay Heaps the problem?
Yes. The answer to that question is yes, and it's to both, and I will tell you why. Just a thought. If you're on the road in Atlanta, what is perhaps maybe not a good idea to do? Maybe put 9-10 guys behind the ball from the start of the game, give up a goal, get two red cards in the first half. There are game plans that Jay Heaps has done on the road that have failed spectacularly, and most of them involve playing defense.
Wait, are you saying that the game plan was to get two red cards?
No, that's just what happened. Oh, okay. The idea is New England is not very good at outright defending. Mm-hmm. They can't hold the lead. They've proven this time and time again, particularly on the road. They've had leads in Dallas. They've had a 3-goal lead in Seattle. The idea of let's play a 4-2-3-1, put two holding midfielders in front of a back line that's still kind of a mess and play defense against teams like Atlanta, like Dallas, like Toronto on the road simply doesn't work, and Jay Heaps keeps deciding to try and do this. What the New England Revolution are good at, in theory, is attacking, and particularly counterattacking. On the road, they flat out don't do it. They sit back, they play defense, they build from the back, and they wait for their utter destruction. It's just a matter of how it happens. Usually New England gets a lead or scores a goal on the road, and then they screw it up late. In the case of Atlanta, when they lose 7-0, it was a bad game plan. They tried to be overly physical. It backfired spectacularly early and often, and that's how you lose a game 7-0, when you have a bad game plan that gets executed poorly and a couple of things kind of sort of go wrong. VAR decides to throw out two of your guys, rightly so, I think, in both cases. So Jay Heaps is part of the problem as far as the performances on the road. However, there is a larger issue with the New England Revolution that I think everyone kind of knows about. They're owned by the Crafts. Mm-hmm. They have a 26-man roster. At the beginning of the year, was a 23-man roster. We don't have a USL affiliate. We don't send hardly any players out on loan into the USL except our third-string goalkeeper. We only have signed 3 homegrown players in our history. We don't spend a ton of money on international players because we're not good at signing them. There's a lot of other little issues that Jay Heaps can't solve, and those are the issues that are above him. That is the culture of the organization that it has effectively made them the Tampa Bay Rays of MLS, and not only MLS, but MLS 2.0, when that is New England effectively is going to build from within MLS via the draft, via trades, and they're going to try and put together a really good team, and once every 10 years they'll be good and make a playoff run. Or at least that's how the last 10 years have gone, or so it seems. The Jay Heaps era, 6 years, a couple of playoff runs, including one trip to MLS Cup. That was a great year. That was the peak of the New England Revolution under Jay Heaps era. Everyone will not deny this. Why was that the peak? Well, because you went out and you signed Jermaine freaking Jones in August. And when you add a player of that caliber to a team that's already kind of good, which I think New England is. New England's not a bad team. New England's just inconsistent as hell. And even in 2014, they were inconsistent as hell. So it's not just Jay Heaps. There are other issues that not even Jay Heaps can solve. But do I think Jay Heaps helped his own case the last couple of years by winning? I think it's one game on the road the last couple of years. No, he didn't. But it's not just a Jay Heaps problem, but we don't have all day to talk about it, unfortunately.
So I guess Michael and I talked about this earlier. What we were hoping is that the Heaps strategy would continue at least for one more game. Say one that as this podcast drops tonight, where, you know, you guys give up a lot of goals and, you know, lose on the road. Is that potentially still the strategy, or do you think that they're going to try and do something different?
Well, I will say that the two teams that Jay Heaps most recently lost to, that those two teams being Atlanta and Kansas City, I think those are two good soccer teams. And I will say that I don't think that Orlando City is good. I do not think that Orlando City is bad, much like New England, but we are both absolutely not good at soccer. So I have hope that New England will be able to compete in this game. As far as the strategy goes, I'm not sure. Lee Wynn came off the bench against Toronto, which was amazing, and he did a lot of really good things, like scoring a goal and assisting a goal as the Rebs beat a depleted Toronto team for the second time in Gillette for no reason. And I think I look at Orlando and I sort of see a similar team to the Rebs in that, God, this team should be better. They're not all that great at defense, but they can score, which leads me to believe, all right, well, we'll see goals midweek. Again, logic dictates this, so obviously we won't have any goals. I don't know. It's kind of one of those things. I think these are two teams that play a very similar style. I don't know if the Rebs will keep the 4-2-3-1. They had a lot of success in the diamond midfield, but the diamond midfield was predicated on the fact that you had Kellen Rowe, Diego Fagundes, and you don't have those guys anymore. You've only got Fagundes. Teal Bunbury's been playing a little bit more out wide because he's just been a machine the last couple months. My gut tells me you'll see the 4-2-3-1 again. Whether or not it's a combination of Lee Wynn in the middle, Aguidello out wide, Aguidello up top, Kamara up top, some sort of. I don't think you'll see a drastic change in tactics from the Revolution. It's not really their method to mess around with things, even under Jay Heaps or now Tom Schoen as the head coach. You'll see a similar style. I think, you know, as I said earlier, the more New England counterattacks on the road, the better they'll be. They're going to want to press a little bit defensively. They're going to want to get upfield quickly and, you know, get the ball into, you know, Kamara and Aguadillo and win in and around the attacking third and just let things happen. So, you know, both teams are banged up. Both teams have, Orlando has red card suspensions. I'm not sure if New England has anyone out on suspension anymore. It's hard to keep track. We've had so many of them, but we didn't get a red card against Toronto, so I think we're in the clear. But the lack of Kellen Rowe and Lee Wynn for the first 70 minutes against Toronto was incredibly noticeable. And if Lee Wynn isn't available or isn't 100%, I think you'll see the difference between him when he's on or off the field, depending on if he starts.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Wynn because he's listed as something you don't often see on the injury report, muscle spasm. And it doesn't specify where that muscle might be. So, I mean, it's technically a heart is a muscle. But
I think it was a hamstring. It could have been like a thigh or something. Like, it's one of those things where it's just something where as he was running or in training, it's just something that bothered him. And so he was available for the Toronto game, but he didn't start. He came off the bench and was fine. So he didn't put in a full shift against Toronto. I understand with the double game week, maybe they want to, you know, rest him again, bring him on at halftime, bring him on at the hour mark, or if start him and if things are going well, take him off at the hour mark. But that's another dangerous strategy because, like I said, New England's not good at defense. So if you take off the guys like Fagundes and Wynn and Aguadillo and Rose already out, now you're losing the ability to counterattack, and now you're just sitting with the ball in your own half or in the midfield third, just giving the ball to the other team and letting them counter on you. So it's kind of a double-edged sword for the Rebs. Like, you want to protect your attacking players in particular for a double game week, and you don't have the luxury, particularly if New England still thinks the season is salvageable, which most of us don't think it is, but you're only 4 points back of the Red Bulls. They have a game in hand, so really you could argue it's closer to 6 points or 7 points. You know, I don't know. It's an interesting situation for New England as far as a short and long term. Whether or not, you know, if you're giving, you know, Tom Schoen an entire, you know, a legitimate look, if you want him to be the head coach, and if you're trying to figure out what you're doing for next year. So there's a couple of interesting ways New England can play this. As far as the lineup or the personnel, I don't expect to see a ton of changes. It's just a matter of, you know, who's in the holding midfield, who's in the center attacking spot, that midfield triangle, and maybe there's one extra option. Aguadillo, Fagundes, Bunbury, two of those three guys should be on the wings, in theory.
All right. Well, you should definitely rest Wynn and Kamara.
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to help the offense or hurt the offense. It's one of those things. New England scores goals in bunches. It doesn't really matter who. You know, Teal Bunbury could play, you know, target striker and just decide, I'm going to score three tonight because why not? You know, New England's funny like that, but you know, I look at Orlando and I know Spector's out on suspension, right?
Yes, that is correct.
All right. So what's your back line looking like?
Well, it looks like it's going to probably be, Sutter and Toya at fullbacks as usual with Redding and Hines in the middle. That seems to be the preferred, go-to when Spector is out. And, he definitely wasn't 100% on Sunday, and that showed. He was a little late on a challenge a couple times, and each one of them was a yellow card. So
it's usually how that works. That doesn't sound as terrible as I was hoping. So
it sounds pretty terrifying from Mars' perspective.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, is Tommy Redding still not good at soccer, or is it just he's not getting enough minutes?
Tommy's young and inconsistent. Fell asleep on one of the Portland goals the other night, fell asleep at Atlanta and allowed Joseph Martinez to tie the game the week before. So, yeah, he's not great in the air, which is a problem when you're going up against Kai Kamara.
Which was actually my next question that I had is in regards to Kai, because we have a special dislike for him. You know, Not just from his time with you guys, but of course his time with Columbus. He seems to have a penchant for finding the goal against Orlando City, and quite frankly, we're sick of him. I know that's why Michael was asking if perhaps he could sit tonight rather than see any minutes. But I'm sure I don't think that'll happen. From your guys' perspective, how has it been having him in this topsy turvy up down season?
You know, it's very similar to what New England has been the last couple of years. They're very streaky, and it's streaky as a team. So every other month, it seems like someone's really, really hot. Last month, for no reason in particular, it was Teal Bunbury. The guy was scoring off the bench. He was scoring as a starter. Now he's getting minutes because Kellen Rowe's out, and the best guy to replace Rowe's workman-like performance on the wing is Bunbury, which is fine. As far as Kai is, people always debate, is Kai a perfect fit up top in a 4-2-3-1 for New England? Probably not. Was he a better strike partner with Juan Aguilera when they were running kind of a diamond midfield with two strikers? Maybe. It's hard to figure out. He's leading the team in goals. He's doing, I think, a lot better than he was last year. I think he's got 12 this year. I don't remember how many he had last year. I don't think he cracked double digits, but I could be wrong on that. Because I don't think anyone last year cracked double digits. The real story for New England right now is just Lee Wynn. If Lee Wynn is on the field and he's creating, either for himself or for someone else, New England is a far superior team. What we haven't had this year is kind of sort of, the other, you've had, Juan Aguilera and Teal Bunbury have been scoring goals. I think Diego Fagundes has chipped in a few, and Rose had a whole bunch of assists. But we haven't had a lot of, the supporting cast spreading out and scoring goals. We've really had to focus on mostly Kamara on the scoring end, and then Lee Wynn doing everything. And usually there's a little bit more production from other places. And we've had other guys are tallying in with either assists or goals, and it's not really a combination of both. You'd love to see someone like Diego Fagundes around, 10 goals, 10 assists, or Kellen Rowe around that number. And I think both those guys have 5 or 6 assists, and Diego's got a few goals, and Rowe's got none, but now he's hurt, so it doesn't matter. You're looking for the supporting cast or the rotating cast around the strikers and around Wynn to be contributing on offense, and that comes and goes. And that means you have to rely on the core guys up front, those three guys, and that's not really how this team is built sometimes. You don't want to just be feeding Kai Kamara headers all the time. You don't want to just be relying on Lee Wynn to dribble past someone and score. You don't want to rely on Juan Aguilera poaching at the back post or Bunbury finishing something in the box. You need to have everyone contributing. And when you're relying on a team like that by committee, sometimes you have dry spells and you go on the road and in particular you're not trying to attack, you lose a lot of attacking opportunities. So I look at Kai Kamara. I don't know his particular success against Orlando City. Obviously you guys don't like him, so he's obviously been scoring goals. But my guess is if you look at the Revolution's road record as far as scoring, they probably don't have a ton of goals on the road. Why? Because of just the mentality of, well, we're going to try and play defense, and that's not what this team is good at. So if the Revolution, what you don't want to see is Fagundes or Bunbury or Aguidello driving the ball, on a run, crossing the ball, on a counterattack, and to see Kai Kamara just in the box waiting. You don't want to see that. You want to limit the amount of time that Kai Kamara has to attack the ball. If it's or New England trying to attack a set Orlando defense, a regular buildup, that's going to be beneficial to Orlando. The more you allow the Revs to get on the front foot, to get out on the counter, to create turnovers, use their speed, that's when Kai Kamara is going to find a gap, or he's going to lay it off to Wynn or Bunbury or Aguilera, someone else who's found space because everyone's focused on Kai. And that's when you probably get in trouble. So that's the strategy sometimes for New England. It doesn't always work. I think sometimes they're too single-minded as far as we're just going to cross the ball to Kai today. We're not going to try and do things in the final third. And You'll tell pretty quickly whether or not it's a good aggressive New England team or a passive New England team. Probably by, you know, 15, 20 minutes in, you'll know if this is a game you guys are winning. If you're watching New England sitting the ball back and Kai Kamara and Lee Wynn aren't getting the ball, you guys are going to be okay.
Well, Jake, before we let you get out of here, we want to get your idea on what the key matchup is on for Wednesday night's game and what your score prediction will be.
Well, my question is Kyle Larin playing, or is he what's his problem right now?
He doesn't have a current problem as far as we know.
Okay, so he should be starting. He just hasn't been scoring recently.
He scored in three in a row until the Portland game.
Until the Portland game? Okay, that's better. I heard it was a lot worse for him last month. So
you didn't see him because he was on international break when we were in New England, but he had scored the game before that, and then he came back and scored in the two games after that.
Gotcha. And there was the suspension thing was kind of in between for a little bit there?
The suspension was about a month and a half, 2 months ago, and it took him a little while to regain his bearings after that.
Which is fine. That happens.
That and he and Dom are now starting to, you know, work together a little bit better, so that's the other thing.
That was my other question. Is it now a two-striker front for Orlando, or are they still doing that weird thing where, like, Dwyer or Laren's kind of like a winger?
Yeah, they're nominally in a 4-4-2 diamond, but there is quite a bit of movement. They switch sides from time to time. They move guys around.
Obviously, the questions for New England right now are more on the defensive end. Left back has been a problem. Chris Tierney's had a couple of better games at home. I'm not sure this is the matchup you want Tierney and his lack of speed trying to deal with one of those two guys. But I also don't love Benjamin Nangua starting because he's a bit of a head case and gets himself a lot of cards for not a whole lot of good reasons. So I'll say it's going to be the Orlando Strikers versus the center back pairing and the back line in general. Antonio De La Mea has been a rock and a very good signing for New England. Has he been Jose Gonsalves 2013 caliber? No, but that's a very elite level. He's been very, very solid and has played practically every minute when he's not on international duty and last week suspended because of a rather unfortunate handball off the line. It's kind of 6 yards off the line, but it was a legitimate blocking of a handball. Mm-hmm. on a goal-bound shot. So new signing Claude Delena from France has been a more steady presence in the middle. I think those two have worked fairly well in the time that they've been there. Notwithstanding, I mean, obviously some of the road games have been tough, but it's not always on them. You need to be able to relieve pressure out of the back, and New England sometimes just refuses to do that, and you concede goals. So, you know, New England's going to be watching a lot of the defense. You know, I'm personally looking more towards next year. I want to see if these two guys are going to be a center back pairing, or if New England has to go out and think to themselves, we still need a center back. We still have problems here. Maybe we can find a guy who can play center back and left back and maybe move him around a little bit. I don't know. We have to see. This is not a perfect roster. You know, there's certainly some decisions New England will have to make. Benjamin and Goa on the back line, whether or not he comes back. The Revs either pick up his contract or let him go back to EA Guingamp in France because he's on loan right now. The team picked up Christian Nemeth, who promptly got himself a red card in Kansas City for reasons unknown to the rest of the world. You know, like I said, you know, I don't think this is a bad New England roster, but I'll be damned if they can't put together a good performance on the road pretty much once a month if they're lucky. So we'll have to see. You know, there's a lot of tentative play when the Revs are on the road, and maybe Jay Heap's replacement, Tom Stone, as head coach, maybe he can change that. It's his first test to really see if maybe Heaps was far more of the problem than we think in New England. But personally, I doubt that. I expect, as I always expect when these two teams play together, for a 2-2 draw for no other reason than this is the eternal 2-2 draw derby. And yep. That will be the final scoreline because Baldomero Toledo said so.
Oh yes, Baldomero Toledo. We, I, I was a little bit of a prophet this weekend because I tweeted out before the game, Baltimore Toledo is your ref tonight. Literally anything can happen. And promptly lost two men to red cards. So, yeah. But although I will say that the two yellows on Spectre were probably warranted. The first one was maybe a little bit iffy, but the second one was a definite yellow. And the red card on PC was definitely warranted. So, but Jake Catanese, our good friend from the Bent Musket, tell people where they can find you on online.
You can find me on Twitter at jcatanese43, at thebentmusket.com. Trying to get my home internet working. We watched some Open Cup qualifying over the weekend. Newtown, Connecticut defeated once again in qualifying. We're very, very distraught over this. New York, Pan Cyprian Freedoms moving on to play the Lansdowne Boys, an all-New York battle in round two. And obviously, yeah, we've had a lot of chatter on the J-Heaps thing the past couple of weeks. I was on Dan Feuerstein's podcast, Feuerstein's Fire, for Once a Metro yesterday. You can go to onceametro.com or Dan's Twitter and find that. It's been a long week for New England. The two road games, the 7-0 game in Atlanta was just absolutely soul crushing, and then you know firing heaps. It made sense. I'm not sure it's, you know, like I said, it's kind of a move where I'm not sure New England's trying to salvage the season or just get ready for next year. Mm-hmm. Part of me thinks they think, no, we haven't been eliminated from the playoffs yet. Let's try and win a few more games. You know, that strategy needed to happen a long time ago, if that was the idea. So, like I said, it's one of those things, you know, people ask me, are you surprised they fired heaps? You know, yes and no. You know, no, I'm not surprised you fire a head coach after you lose a soccer game 7-0. But it's the revolution. This isn't exactly something that they normally do. Steve Nichol didn't get fired. He got to see out his final year that went pretty much about as badly as Heaps did now. And then they rebuilt. And I don't think the revolution are going to rebuild this team. So I'm kind of interested to see short and long term what this team does to address the issues that they have, and if it's going to be Tom Schoen as head coach, or if they're going to go out and find someone else, it'll be an interesting final month for the year. And we have to assume if one of us loses tomorrow, this is a loser leaves town match. Like, we can eliminate ourselves if we lose tomorrow, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be a thing, right?
Yeah, Orlando City is definitely mathematically out if they lose and the Red Bulls win. So.
Okay. We're in that range already.
Yeah. So that's not good. That would be the earliest that the Lions have been eliminated in their 3-year history in Major League Soccer. So not great, Bob, as they would say on the Mad Men. Jake Catanese from the Bent Musket. Thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. Always nice to have you on, and we'll talk to you sometime down the road.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
Okay, well, Dave, we're going to head into stoppage time in episode 105 here on the Mainland Podcast. I always call it stoppage time recently, but it's like, you know, it's 20 to 30 minutes long. So, kind of like the DC United game on the road. But tonight, we have no Ask the Mainland Podcast questions, Dave.
I know why.
Because the team sucked on Sunday?
And nobody wants to talk about it, just like we don't want to.
This is true. And I think it's also because people want to ask us about the off-season stuff, and we've already answered about all the stuff from the off-season that we can going into next year. We've already given our answers on Jason Kreis. We've already given our answers on what changes that we think the team needs to make. And so now it's just a waiting game. But that's because people just want to ask us about soccer, and they don't have to, Dave. They can ask us about food, restaurants. They can ask us about movies, television shows, whatever is on their mind, Dave. All they have to do is tweet to us on the Twitters at the Mainland and use the hashtag AskTMLPC. That's all they have to do.
We are Renaissance men.
That's true.
And so, I mean, you know, and especially for our fellow beer connoisseurs out there, my goodness, we even talked about having a whole off-season podcast about beer because we love beer. So there's that. There's and I know both you and I watch TV. We as a matter of fact, you know, we were even chatting earlier about a particular show that we're both watching right now. You know, so yeah, come on, guys. We just want to answer questions. It's really what we're here to do.
That's right. Tweet us at the mainland and use the hashtag AskTMLPC, or you can email us themainland@gmail.com is how you would reach us to ask us your questions, ask us anything. And Dave, you mentioned the show that we're both watching. You and I are both watching the new HBO program, The Deuce, which is made by the creators of The Wire, I believe. And I want to know, have you watched all three episodes so far?
Let me think. I don't think. Wait. Yes. Yes, I have. I have.
So, I mean, we're not going to give any spoilers out, obviously. But I just want to get your general overall thoughts so far of the series. That's my Ask the Mainland podcast question.
Okay. So, overall in the series, it's developing slower than I thought it was going to be, which is a good thing, you know, given what the premise was supposed to be. They're not that they're drawing it out, but they're taking their time, which is great, because that means that we get more in depth, we get more detail. James Franco is doing a phenomenal job, and quite frankly, he looks awesome as a, you know, 70s, 80s, you know, mustache wearing guy. So he's great there. And then Maggie Gyllenhaal is doing a wonderful job playing the single mom who's also a prostitute. And once again, doing that 70s look thing, great. So I think the production level is really nice, especially, you know, you and I are a little bit older. We kind of remember the 70s and all that. And so it's neat to see all that. But so far, the story is good. They are taking the time to flesh it out.
No pun intended.
No
right?
pun intended yeah. there, but they're fleshing it out nicely. It's both visual, intellectual, and you know, and then just regular old entertaining at the same time. So I think they've got something there.
They're really doing a great job of capturing the gritty, dirty feel of that, of Times Square and that era. You know, before New York really cleaned up that area, it was pretty horrible. And they've done a really nice job of capturing that, I think. And, you know, I mean, they did a great job in showing the dilapidated decay of Baltimore in The Wire. They're doing a really good job with these New York sets and the look and the feel. And even just the attention to detail in the show is unbelievable, down to like the pricing on the menu boards for like the sandwiches and the fries and stuff. And the other thing was you know, there's a scene where there are two pimps, they're talking and they're making small talk, and they're talking about Nixon and in Vietnam. Yeah. And it's so authentic. It's just so, I mean, it's just really well done. You know, it's not going to be for everyone. I will warn people that, you know, it is about the birth of the porn industry, or the porn explosion. So it's not going to be, you know, wholesome family entertainment. You're going to get language. You're going to get nudity. You're going to get sexual situations. It's all there. But it is it never becomes about that, and it never becomes gratuitous, because it's always serving the story. And I think that so far it's doing a good job. It is a slow burn, but it's really doing a good job of introducing the characters and developing the characters. And the only thing I will add to your James Franco remark is that he could probably spend a little less time smiling at his other self. Because he plays twins in the show, and it's almost meta the way he's smiling, and you know he's smiling at himself, and well, it almost looks like it's like it's written on his face. It's like, I'm smiling, but I'm smiling at me, you know.
Right, and you're right, because if he was truly in character, the main, I'm going to say the main James Franco character versus the brother James Franco character shouldn't be all that happy with the brother James Franco character.
Right, right.
I don't want to give any spoilers, but yeah, he would be a little bit more upset with him.
I think he'd be a little more annoyed with him, as being kind of a jackass, but so that's why it sort of plays as meta to me. It's like I'm smiling, you little Dickens. Even, you know, it's like, no, you shouldn't be smiling. You should be thumping him on the head like a real brother would be. But
exactly, but
you know, other than that one little sour note for me, I think that the rest of it has been pretty phenomenal. So there's your Ask the Mainland podcast, and you didn't even ask and we told you anyway to go watch The Deuce and give it a shot and see what you think.
Just as an example of the fact that we can talk about things other than soccer.
That's right. We are learned men, as they
say. Technically, I think we are, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so two games this week, Dave. In addition to the Pride being at North Carolina Saturday night and OCB traveling to Richmond on Sunday, we're going to talk about the Lions. That's primarily why we're here. We do like to talk about all our teams, but you know, the MLS team is you know, what we're primarily known for, and they are going to host two games this week at Orlando City Stadium Wednesday night. As this drops on Wednesday, it would be tonight against the New England Revolution, trying to get a little revenge for that 4-0 shellacking a few weeks back. And then FC Dallas comes in on Saturday to try to get their postseason push jump started, you know, at the expense of the Lions. And what better place to get that started? But Dallas has been in just absolute. Dallas has actually mirrored Orlando City. Both teams were on the top of the heap early in the season, and then both teams have spiraled uncontrollably toward the bottom of the standings. Orlando City has just fallen a little bit further than FC Dallas. FC Dallas still has a chance to get a couple results and get in. And I guess technically Orlando City does too, but it's a less than 1% chance, they say, and I never listen to them. But anyway, what are your key matchups and predictions for the New England Revolutions, first of all?
Okay, so for New England, it's going to be whoever the heck we have at center back positions versus Kamara and Wynn and whoever else they decide to throw at us. It's as we heard in the interview, we've got two similar teams. They can both score, they both can't defend, and without Spectre out there, that's my biggest worry. So that's my matchup, is how do Tommy and whoever the heck else we have in there, if it's Hines or, you know, it doesn't matter. How do they hold up? We've talked about how Tommy occasionally, you know, has a game where he's not all there, but occasionally he has a brilliant game. Not as occasionally as when he doesn't, but, you know, if he can have a great game, then I think that Orlando can, you know, can pull out a win, because it's entirely possible we're going to score on the other end, you know, because New England doesn't have a good back line and we have scorers. Same versus same going on here. So it almost feels like whoever gets to the, you know, to five first wins or something. I don't think it'll be that bad. I hope it's not that bad. So anyway, how our center backs play versus their scorers, in particular Kai Kamara, who we hate, and Wynn. That being said, I'm going to go with both teams do the same thing, and we ended up with a 2-2 draw.
Yeah, I think for me, because the fact that these teams are sort of similar in that they are good attacking teams but bad defending teams, I think that the real key matchup for me is in the midfield, is which midfield wins the game. Which team's midfield is the one that gets their team on the front foot instead of the other one? I mean, that's where it's going to all happen for my money. And I think we've seen two pretty mundane games out of Yoshimar Yotun the last two games at Atlanta and at Portland. I think he wasn't quite as good as he had been in the previous game. So if we can get Yoshi back to where he was, I think we might be able to win that midfield battle and be able to get on the front foot rather than stay on the back foot. The other thing I think we might see is I think we might see Kaká this week. I think because he didn't play a single minute at Portland and because of the quick turnaround, I think that there might be a little bit of squad rotation. And, you know, I guess it's not that bad to have a Ballon d'Or winner to come in your squad rotation, even though he hasn't had a great season. I mean, he's always...
He's still Kaká.
A threat, yeah. I mean, he's always got a couple of moments of magic throughout the game in him, and it's just a matter of does it come off or does it not, and that's not always up to him. Sometimes that's up to who he gives the ball to. So, sure. I think the midfield is where the game is won and lost. That's my key matchup, and I will say also 2-2 because we can't have nice things, and because these teams just really like 2-2 draws. They've done it three times already in their history.
Yeah.
And I see no reason for it to change now.
But of course, we were both really wrong about last weekend, so hopefully we're both wrong this time and we win.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Yeah. Okay, so FC Dallas, hit me with your key matchup and your score prediction.
All right, so FC Dallas. Dallas, as we mentioned, have not been good. They are winless in their last 10 games. As much as I would like for that to bode well for us, it almost gives me a sense of foreboding in that, you know, it's like, okay, maybe this is the time they turn around. But regardless, so in this game, this is where I go for the midfield and the need for them to provide the opportunities for Kyle and Dom up top. You know, whether it's Yoshi, whether it's Kaká coming in, either starting or off the bench, you know, depending on how Wednesday goes. We need to get some service into those guys up top. And I think how they do that, if they're winning those battles and getting the ball in, that's what makes the difference. Because it's the second game within the week and we have no idea who's going to play, who's going to get hurt, who's going to do anything, I'm just going to go ahead and be optimistic. I'm going to say FC Dallas doesn't get back on the winning side and we actually win at home 2-1 in a game that won't matter.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's see. The FC Dallas match Saturday afternoon will be the third game in 7 days for Orlando City. At least they won't have to travel between Wednesday and Saturday. But yeah, that's a lot of soccer.
Yeah, but we'll have Specs back.
That's a lot of soccer. Yeah, we might have Jonathan Spector back for the weekend. My key matchup is going to be the Orlando City attack against that backline for FC Dallas. I know that they've been a little bit maligned this year, but they are capable of putting up a stone wall in front of Jesse Gonzalez. So I would say that that's my key matchup is can Dom and Kyle or whoever else might be in there. Can they make that final ball? I mean, can they make it work? The Orlando City team has not yet scored a goal against FC Dallas in its history. So that's not great, Bob. we've had a lot of trouble against them, especially their defense. So that's my key matchup. And I will say that at the end of a very busy week with some travel involved in there as well, we're going to get a stinker of a 0-0 draw.
And you'll probably be right.
Because that's just the way it goes. That way neither team can be happy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, obviously I hope that both of them are wins instead of draws or losses. And obviously you hope that as well.
Obviously.
We have gone with what our gullets have told us. And, you know, my gut can sometimes be an idiot, but sometimes it can be scarily correct. I mean,
To be fair, I went with my heart on the second one. I went with my gut on the first one.
Okay. Well, I was really scary close on the preseason pride predictions. I was looking back at my pride predictions from the preseason and noted that the five teams vying for the four slots were the exact five teams I thought. I did predict that the pride would finish third, which could still happen, but they've definitely finishing fourth or third. And then I also said that my wild out of the box prediction was that Alex Morgan returns from Lyon and ignites a scoring explosion and that her and Marta combine to score 25 goals. And that could still happen. They have combined for 21 goals between the two of them. So they would each need a brace or some combination thereof at North Carolina to make that come true. But that is a pretty good analysis. I also, you know, you and I have talked on the podcast about how they would start slowly and they would need to gel and stay healthy. And they have, for the most part, they've stayed healthy. They have gelled and come together as the season goes on. A lot of people don't realize this team only won one of its first seven games and none of its first five, I want to say. And here they are in the playoffs. So that's just okay. A testament of how quickly they came together and turned things around.
Okay, hold on. That's a golf clap. Oh. Golf clap for Michael.
I thought that was the sound of one hand clapping.
No, that was a golf clap okay. for Michael.
I thought that was more like...
For doing a great prediction.
well, you know, I'd had to toot my own horn because I'm wrong on here so often.
if we had to acknowledge every time that we're wrong, we wouldn't have any time to interview anybody.
Yeah. All right, guys. So that will just about do it. Our stoppage time is over. We're gonna blow this whistle dead. We're gonna put a stop to this thing now and call it a day on episode 105. Again, we want to thank Jake Catanese from the Bent Musket for coming on and chewing our ears off about the Revolution and letting us know in no uncertain terms that they have just as many problems as we do, but they are still ahead of us in the standings, and that won't change even if the Lions win on Wednesday night. So so screw you guys. So that thanks to Jake, and of course we would read you our 5-star reviews on iTunes, but there aren't any new ones. I could read some old ones from before Dave's time, but I won't put him through that. If you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and you know, leave us your comments there, we will read them on air. So that's something to think about, and also it helps us reach more people. So tell your friends. Tell your family, spread the word about the Mainland Podcast if you like what we do here, and please leave us an iTunes rating. You can do that at iTunes, obviously. Please read themainland.com. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all that good stuff. We are at The Mainland, and we are facebook.com/themainland, and we are at themainland.com. So it's all The Mainland everywhere you look on all the channels. So that will do it for episode 105. On behalf of David Rowe, I am Michael Citro, the founder and managing editor of themainland.com, apologizing for my voice, which is about to give out, and I'm signing off the way I always do by saying, Go City!